For the last segment of our program, I asked the faculty to take a step back and look at the macro world of cancer research, specifically where we are and where we're headed, and to some extent, I attempted to gently and humbly, quote, get up in their faces and tell us how we can come up with quicker solutions to the cancer and breast cancer problems. To prime the discussion, I showed a slide set describing the current cancer mortality figures for breast and other cancers. This was the fourth consecutive week this summer that our CME group hosted a major think tank, first colorectal, then prostate, then lung, and finally this breast cancer think tank, and my fourth attempt at raising blood pressures around the room. Dr. Sledge began the discussion.
Certainly, if you wanted to have a huge impact, you'd want to get rid of environmentally caused cancers. You know, it's fascinating to me that just simply getting, as Peter has shown, you know, getting rid of Prempro drops the breast cancer incidence 7% in a year or two. I mean, that's huge. And it makes you wonder how much low-hanging fruit there is out there that we could snatch off, not just in breast cancer, but in several cancers. Some of that low-hanging fruit is fairly obvious. You know, you look at the cervical cancer data with papillomavirus vaccines, and you look at the recent epidemiologic data suggesting that a lot of head and neck cancer is caused by papillomavirus. I mean, head and neck cancer is an awful cancer that, even with the advances we've seen in recent years, we really haven't hugely affected. So if I were king of the world, I would probably try and knock off that cancer by doing a papillomavirus vaccine study a la the cervical cancer in cigarette smokers. I mean, I think there are a number of low-hanging fruit things that represent either modifications in how we live or targeting of fairly well-documented causation of cancer. I think it obviously would require something at a social level as well. When you get past that, I think for breast cancer and for most of the solid tumors, we are talking about families of cancers rather than individual cancers. And for those families of cancers, I think we are stuck with the idea that we're going to have to, in essence, once we get past things like vaccine strategies, are going to have to think in terms of attacking each of those cancers as an individual cancer within the family. And that's going to mean better understanding of the biology of those individual cancers. We have a pretty good sense of ER-positive cancer. We have a pretty good sense of HER2-positive cancer. We still have a lousy sense of what's driving triple-negative cancers. So, you know, we're going to have sort of more focus on individual subtypes of breast cancer. As, you know, Dennis certainly has suggested multiple times, we have to be thinking in terms of biology driving the process rather than population-based studies that we've done in the past.
Dennis, I'm discouraged, honestly, deeply discouraged and concerned. What can we do about this?
Well, and you know, I think I understand at least part of the reason for your discouragement, but the reality is there are a number of things that are going on simultaneously. You listed some pretty impressive numbers that I think everyone would agree with, but it doesn't take into consideration the fact that it probably does, but I mean, you didn't state it, the population is aging, and cancer is a disease of aging, and if you lived in a bubble and lived your life perfectly and did all the right things, still every time a cell divides, unless it does it with complete fidelity and picks up every mistake is made, you're at risk of making a mistake in a critical pathway that'll cause cancer.
I mean, do you think that paradigm really is the cancer story and that a molecular targeted approach really will be the answer?
I think it'll be a significant part of the answer. It won't be the only answer. You bring up and Lee's mentioned, and everybody says it. To argue against it would be arguing against mom and apple pie. The prevention strategies are the best. To prevent something, however, you have to know what the etiologic events are. At least you have to have some understanding of what the etiologic events are for optimum prevention. And so it still gets back to going into the trenches and slugging it out to work out the biology. How did you get from a normal cell to a malignant transformed cell? What made that conversion? And how do you stop that? How do you reverse it once it occurs? And how do you prevent it from occurring in the first place? I don't know how you get that information without data.
Well, let me qualify that a little bit. If we're talking about cancers as a whole rather than just breast cancer, if I look at a cancer like lung cancer, which as I understand its etiology is that you bathe bronchial epithelium in carcinogens for 3 decades, you know, all of those cancers have huge numbers of mutations in them. I mean, all of them. You know, if you look at the recent data from the lung cancer literature, I think an approach that doesn't strongly involve manipulation of sociology as opposed to physiology is going to be doomed to failure for certain cancers that we deal with.
Peter?
I think that the business about aging is really where it's at. I think that over the next 50 years, the big breakthroughs are going to be an understanding of mammalian aging processes. We already have a lot of information in animal models, and we can extend life expectancy of virtually every animal that's been looked at by about 50%. And it's actually due to a decreased rate of the diseases of aging, which you just pointed out, one of which is cancer. So we can actually slow cancer rates. The problem right now is that you have to eat a near starvation diet, but that causes certain molecular changes in pathways that actually clearly are protective against the major killers. And there's a lot of work ongoing about how to achieve those same things without bankrupting American farmers. And I think that this is one of those situations where the attack on the problem of cancer has got to be viewed as part of a broader attack, which includes sociology. I mean, right now, you know, in high school, a lot of high schools, you have to take half a year of physical education. I mean, there is virtually, you know, we have rampant problems. The thing is, I also agree with you about money, though. I think that one of the problems is that a lot of these situations, the studies, the impetus to do it, a lot of things are driven in our society by the fact that somebody's going to make money out of having this happen, this change occur. And a lot of the things having to do with prevention aren't going to make anybody any money because they're not patentable. And so either the nation has to decide as a whole to invest in this by investing more in national clinical trials programs, or by changing patent laws, they have to make it possible to make some of the prevention strategies commercially viable. Because one of the problems with prevention strategies is they take so long to establish that you have very little kind of life on your patent by the time you get done with it. So I think there are commercial barriers and sociologic barriers to addressing things. I view this as a problem that if we just address cancer, it's too narrowly defined. It is a problem of aging. And the way is, how can you cause people to age slower? And I don't think you're ever going to be able to get rid of the molecular errors that get made. Just the more often your cells divide, the more often the mistake can get made. I mean, we're never going to do anything about background radiation.
One of the interesting things about prevention to me is that, you know, cancer is such a dichotomous, you either have it or you don't kind of problem. If you don't have it, you're fine. And if you do have it, you have a bad problem. And it's very hard to get people excited about prevention in those circumstances, because even with effective prevention drugs, you run into problems like number needed to treat being huge. If you look at the heart disease literature, people love following their cholesterol levels. Hey, cholesterol went from 246 down to 175. Half the country is on Lipitor. The number needed to treat with Lipitor for preventing heart attacks is actually very similar to the number needed to treat with tamoxifen to prevent breast cancer.
It's identical.
It's identical. Thank you. But there's nothing in between that makes you feel like you're doing something. I think it's one of the paradoxes of cancer prevention that there isn't that intermediate surrogate that allows people to feel like they are engaged in their own healthcare. And I think if we had something like that, which I honestly have no idea what it would be, but if we had something like that, it would be a lot easier to engage people in this process.
Joyce, I understand the interest in prevention. Let's just put that aside for a second. Let's focus on treatment, because people are going to get this disease one way or the other. Again, any thoughts about how we can maybe change the paradigm, change our approach to the research on this issue, come up with answers in a different way?
Well, I've heard people sometimes talk about a Manhattan Project or some sort of very intensive national effort to really try to nail down a lot of this molecular circuitry, particularly right in the environment of the particular organ site, stromal epithelial interactions, because it seems like breast cancer is sort of falling into some little neat boxes, and we know there are subtypes underneath there, but maybe some of the patterns of, you know, plasticity or maybe somewhat predictable. Maybe it's not going to all just be chaos. Probably not. We have multiple groups around the world working on this and somehow bringing these data together. And, you know, I really think, you know, again, blank check, patients would be treated much more often with neoadjuvant therapy with serial biopsies. And for metastatic patients, you would do serial biopsies or get circulating tumor cells and really interrogate these cancers to understand the patterns of because ultimately, I think for a lot of cancers, it may be an AIDS model if they're fairly indolent, where you're going to have to block multiple pathways over a long period of time.
If
Final topic or question, I'm going to start with Melody, and it gets back to this issue of diet and exercise in terms of the potential for preventing recurrence. And we had a big discussion about this, as I mentioned earlier, in the colon think tank, because there's very encouraging data there. It's now been 2 years since the WINS randomized trial was presented looking at dietary fat reduction. What are your thoughts about that strategy? Do you think it's something that should be pursued aggressively in ongoing trials, basic science implications? What are you doing in your practice?
Well, I think that it's a very important study. I think it was confounded by the fact that there was more weight loss, so maybe it was the weight loss and not the fat reduction. But I think it's something that needs to be supported and repeated. I don't understand why it just affected estrogen receptor negative breast cancer, but that's an interesting observation in and of itself.
Frankie?
I think the whole issue of diet and exercise is extremely important, and this is a limitation that I have in my practice because I've tried to work with the physical therapy people to set up a local program. When my patients finish their adjuvant therapy and they've gained weight and I have a great expectation of cure for them, now I'm faced with a woman who's got an increased risk of cardiovascular disease, and I don't think we can look at these diseases in isolation. And I like your analogy to the cholesterol because there are some genetic things that we know are going on with some of these patients, but they're clearly modified by environmental factors, and we've got to tackle them together. I think if we get a win on some of the breast cancer and the cardiovascular stuff by linking together some common ground, that might be a way that we could use dollars for both things. I think that recent study that came out, I think it was the WELL study, where they were saying, oh gosh, isn't it terrible that taking 9 or more vegetables or fruits a day was not any better than 5 to 7? Everybody was decrying that. I think it was wonderful because the control arm learned. Most of our patients don't take 5 to 7 vegetables a day, but the control arm in that group learned, just like in the other study where the patients got wind of what was going on and they started to live a healthier life.
Bill?
Part of the problem, too, is it's a lifelong behavior. You know, most of these interventions are undertaken later in adult life. They're made when a patient has a diagnosis of cancer, and then we're looking for the effect, whether it's a decrease in recurrence, decrease in the incidence. But where populations have been studied where there's less cancer, Asia, wherever, these are lifelong patterns of behavior that don't start when you're an adult. They start when you're a kid.
Taking junk food out of the cafeteria and out of the cafeteria food for our children, getting rid of the trans fats, all of that's a big step, I think.
Lee?
So we haven't talked much about early detection, and to put those two together, if we had some kind of technology that could show patients at risk for developing cancer, premalignant changes, for example, in breast, using any technique you can think of, maybe proteomics or maybe using increased angiogenesis as a precursor, then you could target interventions that would be relatively low cost where people would be interested. As Hal said, you'd have then that marker about who's at risk and who needs to modify that. So I don't think it's impossible to say that that could happen in the future.
George?
Here's a fascinating piece of medical technology data. If you look at brain scans, MRI scans, going back to the early to mid-1990s, every 18 months there's been a doubling of resolving capacity in these scans. Now, if you approach that from a general technology standpoint in terms of cancer imaging and you project it forward a decade or two, you get to a point in the not-too-distant future where we're going to be able to identify small clumps of cancer cells. Now, a big part of our problem has been knowing who to treat and when to treat in the microscopic metastatic disease setting. If you combine that sort of ability to find small clumps, perhaps with functional imaging, that would allow you to say that small clump is now sensitive to difungomuctane. Okay. Then you are actually getting to a very powerful point in human technology where we are going to be able to eliminate perhaps microscopic deposits of cancer cells. I think 10, 15 years from now, and this is not irrational to believe it might happen, 10, 15 years from now, you go in to the doctor's office, you get the scan says you've got 18 cancer cells in the left lobe of your liver. And by the way, while you were there in the scanning machine...
19.
Thank you.
20.
We killed all of them. Go home. You know, that's not an impossible future to believe in.
That's Star Trek.
We actually have a big problem, I think, in terms of what the general population understands about their own health, about health education, about how clinical research and biological research in general are done. I mean, we still have states in this country that are debating whether or not to teach evolution, so I guess it's not a big surprise that there would be other deficiencies in health education. But, you know, we often have people who want to sort of focus on things because they think it's a good idea, whether it's fruits and vegetables or diet and exercise. Most of these people who we take care of need health educators to explain to them how we learned what we learned, what we mean by results of clinical trials, how these results translate to them. And I think as a community, we've actually done a very poor job of explaining what stake the population has in these kinds of efforts. And I think we'd find more broad-based support for funding and for clinical trials and for other strategies if we did a better job of that. And until we do, actually, I'm concerned that we're not going to see more broad-based political social support for these kind of projects.
I wonder whether we almost, I hate to even say this, I'll just say it to be provocative, you know, after having discussed this in the four think tanks, I wonder whether in a sense we've almost given up, that we just are not going to be able to figure out this disease and how to get rid of it. Dennis?
So Neil, you've actually touched on this before in terms of taking what I think you do, and not to be patronizing, but what you do very well with the medical community, take it out to the public at large. And I think there's a real need for that, because there are actually surveys that show the perceptions among the public is really varied on cancer. When you talk with what concerns patients, health is number one, and over income and terrorism and everything else, and then within health, it's cancer. And then when you ask them, what do you think your risk of developing a malignancy is, the numbers vary from 1 in 100 to 1 in 600. They'll tell you their individual risk, when in fact, for men living a normal life, that it's 1 in 2, and for women, it's 1 in 3. And the fact that I don't think anyone in the general population in large numbers really appreciates that allows the kind of funding decisions to go on that have been going on. Because I think, again, in your early slides, you pointed it out very well. I'm not near as discouraged as you are that it's all going to be doom and gloom. I think we're really beginning to understand that these diseases represent not histologically based diseases, but a group of changes that occur that are going to occur no matter how well we do things, and we got to figure it out, categorize the patients correctly, and treat them effectively with the right categories.
And it's not just a question of discouragement, but also, I mean, really just looking at the devastation that this disease is causing that you see every day. I mean, it's amazing when you see what oncologists do every day and, you know, the kinds of things they have to discuss with patients every single day. And I think it's maybe more anger. You know, I think we need more angry people. Just a thought.